From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at what both buyers and sellers can expect for the 2022 housing market. Then, we'll learn more about a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigation into electrical fires after a man was killed.
So this is, in essence, a wrongful death claim, and it's based in negligence. It's based in the landlord's duty to really ensure that these electrical issues and that these homes are up to a code that we all deserve.
We'll learn how working from home during the pandemic and moving work online has impacted cybersecurity and ransomware attacks.
We're just opening up the doors and becoming a bit more ripe for things like ransomware, which easily finds its way into the network through email and or through particular user behavior that may not be as disciplined as we would like.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. For the sixth month in a row, the metropolitan Milwaukee real estate market outperformed the pandemic-fueled market of 2020, according to a recent Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors report. So far in 2021, there have been over 15,000 sales. If trends continue, it looks like 2022 will continue to be a seller's market. To break down some of the factors behind this historically tight housing market, I'm joined by Courtney Stefaniak and Mike Ruzicka of the Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors. Mike begins by recalling what realtors first feared for the housing market when the pandemic hit.
We were thinking, okay, we're heading into a recession, and we were preparing, articles and things for our members to get ready to how to get through a recession because we didn't know how long it was going to be. And then Governor Evers actually declared real estate to be an essential service. And that was, kind of opened the floodgates. And from that time on, the market has just been crazy.
From a realtor standpoint, like being out in the field, working with buyers and sellers, in March of 2020, when everything kind of first hit, there was a little bit of a lull for a couple of weeks, kind of when everyone was unsure of what was happening. But, like Mike said, when it was deemed essential, it was back up and running in full swing. And we, had to make a couple of adjustments here and there as far as showings and overlapping appointments and things like that. But we made it work, and it was overall a really great year, and it's continued into this year as well. So yeah, it's been tough with the lack of inventory, but looking back, like at the adjustments that we've made, I thought, we did a really good job.
So the 2020 market kind of continued into 2021, still gaining steam, keeping that same momentum. What factors have contributed to this historically tight market?
I think the low inventory levels that we've been seeing for the past couple of years is probably one of the biggest drivers. And I don't like to call it a bubble, because if there was more inventory, if more people would sell, the market could definitely absorb that. We kind of almost need that inventory. So if more people decided to sell, I don't think that would necessarily be a bad thing. I think there is enough demand out there to accommodate that.
And the bubble we survived in 2008 that caused the huge recession was really driven by free, easy money. There were unscrupulous lenders that were giving money to anybody that could fog a mirror. And people were using it. There were, teachers buying $1 million houses and, on spec. And it was crazy. So we don't have those situations anymore. First of all, a lot of those unscrupulous lenders, I think all in our market, just about all of them are gone, as far as I can tell. And nationally as well. But banks have also, the credible banks that were around and survived, really kind of got serious about lending money. And they said, okay, we've got to make sure people are a good credit risk. So people that are buying now are excellent credit risks, and they have been for going on 10 years. So because there's no funnel of money, easy money coming into the market, there's no bubble. And if there was, we'd see prices probably higher than they are. But what's interesting is if you look at the last 5 years, the current market, I say, started about 2015, 2016, because before that, after the recession, it was a value market where buyers were looking for discounted properties. Around 2015, 16, the market changed what we call, you know, like a normal market where you have move up buyers, new households being formed, getting into the market, and just a traditional market that we've seen, you know, for 200 years. And since that time, if you look at price increases, it's gone up at the same rate every year. It also depends on, like, during the summer market, you know, April, May, June, that's always a peak period of time. So prices might have gotten up a little bit, you know, crazy then, but they've calmed down, and they're you know, even within a year, they get kind of cyclical, and they're about where they should be.
So the trend of buyers offering, you know, 20 more over asking, has that contributed to the numbers you've seen in this report in housing prices and, like, wasn't, quote, average median price, when really it's way more over assessed value? I know there's a lot of that that has been happening.
I feel like we're still seeing a little bit of those aggressive offers, not nearly as much as the beginning of this year. The first quarter of 2021, I've been in this business for 12 years. I haven't experienced anything like that before, where offers, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 over asking. So I feel like it's cooled down a little bit from the first quarter. But like Mike was saying, people have a lot more equity in their homes nowadays. And with the pandemic, lenders have added even more, you know, restrictions. So they're stricter on lending. So anyone that is buying now or is able to buy now is definitely going through that pre-qualified process and is a very qualified buyer.
So it's very much a seller's market. And Courtney, you mentioned there's a demand for more housing. So I'm wondering, where does this leave the home seller? With the people you work with, do people often have a different home lined up when they do decide to sell, because there is such a tight window between selling your home, but also making sure you yourself have a different housing situation to move on to?
Right. That's part of the challenge that we're facing right now, is I'll come in contact with a lot of home sellers who would like to sell and take advantage of the market, but aren't quite sure where they're going to go, whether that's going to be a short-term rental until they can find something else to buy, or a downsize situation because, you know, like we said, there's not a whole lot of inventory out there. So I think the need for more inventory really comes in to the need for more affordable inventory, and really that maybe 350 and under price range, because those are my first time millennial home buyers. But then also it's maybe the older boomer generation looking to sell their bigger home and downsize to something smaller. So that's kind of where we're seeing a lot of that activity and a lot of the aggressive offers being made.
So while the housing market is certainly performing, I'm sure people can't help but notice the continued construction and development of apartment buildings and other rental properties. Do you think we really need this, or is this meeting a need of people needing an in-between space until they can buy? Where do you think the rental market is right now?
You know, the rental has always been an important part of the life cycle of housing. About 2/3 of the population of households total want to purchase a home eventually. And so 1/3 stay in apartments and rental, which is fine. And so there's definitely a need for it. Right now, we're seeing a ton of apartment development, but no condo or single family development. But what's interesting is you talk to apartment developers, they say, but there's demand for my apartments, and we're, you know, commanding high prices, and they're, you know, kind of luxury units. And that's true because there's nothing else for people to move into. So for example, you know, there are a ton of anecdotal examples of people who, empty nesters who want to downsize. So they list their house now because the market's good, and they go to look for a house and they can't find anything. So they say, okay, I'm going to rent for 2 years or a little while until we find something. And there's a lot of that going on in the market. And unfortunately, because there isn't enough new construction on the condo and single family side, they're forced to stay in apartments a little bit longer probably than they expected to. So we need to just, you know, break that logjam somehow.
So listings have grown most of 2021, but let's focus on the metropolitan Milwaukee area to start. How did Milwaukee perform?
great. The city and the county of Milwaukee did really well all year long. And then what's interesting is, you know, people look at, okay, the urban market versus rural. And because of the pandemic causing everyone to work from home and kind of, you know, stay at home more or not travel as much, people really kind of invested in their house. So they, I think that's one of the reasons why prices all over the market increased.
Let's go over what people can expect going into the 2022 market, and let's start with sellers. So I assume 2022 will continue to be a good year to sell your home.
Yeah, it's looking that way. It's still a strong seller's market. If you're considering, definitely still leaning that way. And like we said, you know, even if we do see an uptick in listings, there's still demand. So we can definitely use the inventory.
Are there any trends or needs that most home sellers are having to meet before considering putting their home on the market? Or is it such a hot market that it's a relatively easy thing to transition into?
No, I still think it's important to, you know, make repairs, clean, organize, do all the things that you normally do to prep your house for sale instead of, you know, just throwing it up there and seeing what you can get. Because at the same time, even though it is a seller's market, buyers are smart. There's a lot of information out there online that they can research. So, you know, if something is overpriced, they're going to recognize that. Or if something's, you know, maybe a quick flip, they're going to recognize the quality of the work. So I still think it's important to go through those steps and make your house presentable and show it in its best light before you put it on the market.
So for buyers going into the 2022 market, what can buyers expect?
I think for buyers, it's still really important to go through that pre-approval process first. We've been teaching that from day one. And then also just getting with a realtor and going through the process and understanding how you can write a competitive offer, being creative, you know, adjusting your offer to the seller's needs as best you can so that you can compete if you need to.
The spring of 2021 was record breaking. I don't know that we're going to get back there. I hope we don't, because it really soured a lot of buyers' attitudes towards purchasing, and kind of they were just like, oh. I mean, the people put, you know, 10, 15 bids on houses and lose them all and just get really dispirited. But competition is still going to be there. So people might have to make, you know, 3 or 4 offers. The other thing is on a macro level, you know, the national, both politically and economically, that'll have some impact on the local market. We just don't know how much. Interest rates are still really good. We expect them to be good for the next couple years, probably, even though they're talking about inflation, things like that. You know, there's a lot of discussion about inflation kind of being symptomatic of what's going on right now and not necessarily a systemic problem in the economy. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. But things look good, you know, knock on wood, for a couple years.
Great. Well, Mike and Courtney, thank you for joining me today to share a little bit more insight into the housing market.
Thank you.
Mike Ruzicka is the president of the Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors, and Courtney Stefaniak is a third-generation realtor with the Stefaniak Group and the current chairwoman of GMAR. You can find a link to the association's latest report on home sales at wuwm.com. A recent investigation by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found that Black renters are disproportionately impacted by electrical fires in the city. It also found these electrical fires happen 5 times more frequently in the city's 53206 zip code. WUWM has been partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE. The latest event focused on this investigation by the Journal Sentinel. The event took place on Facebook Live on Tuesday night and was hosted by reporter Raquel Rutledge. We'll hear first from Justin Padway, a Milwaukee attorney representing the family of a man who died in an electrical fire.
A lot of times these fires have and can often have deadly consequences. And in this situation, I represent the family of Clarence Morrell and the estate of Mr. Morrell. And Ms. Colston rented a home located at 3936-3938 North 14th Street from a landlord named Will Sherrard and or Morocco Investments LLC. And exactly the problems that you have uncovered happened at that residence. It was an electrical fire. It was highly preventable. And these types of situations really can be prevented by the landlord. So this is, in essence, a wrongful death claim, a survivorship claim, and it's based in negligence. It's based in a landlord's duty to really ensure that these electrical issues and that these homes are up to a code that we all deserve.
Yeah, and so was there reason to believe in that particular home? I mean, I think our initial investigation found there had been some code violations, previous electrical code violations. In a wrongful death suit like this, is it necessary to prove that this landlord had, you know, the department had warned the landlord? Or is it, you know, that maybe even just if residents had complained to the landlord, is that enough? Or what sort of prior knowledge is necessary in a case like that?
I believe both would be, both are not necessary. Obviously, if you have a tenant continually flagging an electrical issue and you have a landlord is not responsive to that issue and is not doing their due diligence and their follow-up, that would be grounds for the negligence claim. In this situation, we have it even a step further. We have the Department of Neighborhood Services who is documenting the electrical wiring issues, requiring a permit to fix those issues, and we have no fixing of those issues. So in this type of situation, it's a willful disregard, even in a step beyond negligence.
Got it. What about Department of Neighborhood Services, their responsibility? By the way, we did invite the city, representative city officials to join us. They declined. But what is their obligation on this front?
Well, I think the Department of Neighborhood Services obviously had a much bigger role in protecting tenants from these types of situations prior to the law change under Governor Walker. I do believe that there should be 1,000% follow-up when you have these types of issues to make sure that a permit was actually drawn. If you are flagging these issues, I believe it takes everyone really to kind of come together and make sure that this doesn't continually happen. So the DNS is there for a reason. It's there to protect tenants, people in the city. And in this situation, I believe we had a situation that could have been highly preventable.
Yeah. Tell us, how did you find this case? I mean, obviously we've been investigating this and looking at the numbers and finding that one of our initial findings was that, you know, these suspected electrical fires do impact renters in Milwaukee in 53206 at five times the rate of the rest of the city. But I wondered how, we don't hear often of cases like this. And so I wondered where you found this. How did it come to your attention?
So we're a family law firm. We've been around for 70 years. We have consistently helped people that walk through our doors. Our goal is to obviously find justice for people that have been wronged. In this type of situation, just like anything else, we became aware of the situation through the client. We looked at the situation. We saw the injustice that was done. And the client demanded accountability. The Morrell family wanted accountability. They deserved accountability. And when we look at a situation like this and we see that we can make an impact, we can make a difference, not only in Mr. Morrell's memory and his family, but also in this greater problem, we find it, this is why we do what we do. We want to help. We want to make the difference. And we're grateful to be able to do that.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Clarence Morrell. We interviewed family of Patricia Colston extensively, but we weren't able to find Clarence Morrell's family readily. So tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he was a wonderful man. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, he was a young man. And he had a really excellent relationship with his daughter, Angel. He had an excellent relationship with his grandson. He was somebody that was incredibly musical, incredibly kind, and just really always had that joyful smile and that way of life about him. In this situation particularly, he was there at that residence because he was helping Patricia Colston move in. I mean, that's the kind of person that he really was. He lent his hand to anybody. And I guess to just sum it up, he was a family man, just like the rest of us. And this is really hard for the family.
And what we know about that fire, again, that one started early in the morning, 6 a.m., a 911 call from the downstairs neighbors. From what we can tell, I mean, is there anything else you learned in your discovery that you could share with us about the way that fire unfolded. From what we know, the call came in, firefighters got there within 6 or 7 minutes. Yeah, is there any other details that you could tell from, you know,
sure,
that you found?
With what I can disclose is I believe that this was, again, highly preventable on two different reasons. For the first reason, obviously, there was forewarnings of this wiring issues. There was the need for the permit, and it wasn't obtained, and the issues were not corrected. On a second level, a lot of these fires are incredibly dangerous because they don't present themselves in a typical form. They start inside of the walls. So they do not allow for a lot of oxygen, which creates a lot of smoke. Smoke inhalation is the most dangerous thing of a fire. And in these residences, you didn't have smoke detectors. And that's an obligation for a landlord to put smoke detectors in. So not only was this really problematic from the perspective of a negligent upkeep of the house, but there was also statutory violations and not keeping the place up to code with respect to smoke detectors that really could save lives. I mean, they are there because they save lives. And you really have a double whammy in this situation, and you have tragic consequences as a result.
Tell us where you are in the lawsuit. What comes next?
We are currently in discovery. So obviously lawsuits, there's a long road ahead, and we are in the process of discovery and the process of depositions. We do not have a trial date yet set. Discovery, for those that aren't aware, is in essence the information gathering stage, the opportunity to do depositions on important individuals such as fire detectives who determine the cause of the fire, such as Will Sherrard and such as his company.
Yeah, thank you. That is one of the findings of our investigation, was that we often suspect or imagine that when fire investigators come in to check out a fire, that they will nail down the cause of what actually started it. And we were surprised to find that 75% of these fires, fire investigators may suspect an electrical fire. They're very certain. They've ruled everything else out. They can see it behind the walls. But when it comes time to doing the paperwork, they will write it down as an undetermined. Because they don't have electrical engineers on staff, and they don't take it to that next level, and therefore there is no accountability then for the landlord. And one of our other findings was about insurance, and that was this case in this case of Will Sherrard as well. We know that insurance companies will often investigate the fires because they have a vested interest. Well, we found that some landlords, not all, certainly not all, but some landlords don't have their properties insured. They've purchased them for $10,000-$12,000, and it's not insured. And so if the property is not insured, there isn't an insurance investigator. So these investigations stall out. So let's bring our other guests to the conversation. We have a landlord with us. We have Rosemary Oliveira. She owns four rental properties in the city of Milwaukee, in River West, in Harambe. And so Rosemary, welcome.
We also
have Mitch, the director of UW University of Wisconsin's Economic Justice Institute. He is a longtime provider of legal services to low-income families. Thank you for joining us, Mitch.
Thank you for having me.
Rosemary, I want to go to you first as a landlord. Talk to us about the responsibilities that landlords have. As an owner of properties, what is your responsibility for keeping your residents safe?
I feel my responsibility is the ultimate responsibility to keep my tenants safe. And I just dismayed to hear this kind of thing where landlords simply broker their properties among these absentee landlords that are actually just investment companies. And I recently just purchased this property, actually closed on it today. And they assumed that I was an investment company. And they just sort of asked, do you know what you're doing? And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm actually buying a building. And the more I learned about these guys, especially the condition of this building, the angrier I got and the more disgusted I became with them. I had the first inspection and went down with a regular home inspector. And I'm looking at leaking pipes, leaking onto exposed wires in the basement. And I'm standing there also with the company that's supposedly doing their property management here in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee. And I believe these people are also culpable in this. He goes, yeah, that's on our list. I'm like, wouldn't you kind of fix that right away? And he goes, yeah, well, we'll get to it. And I'm like, okay. And So I called in this, I got a city inspector. It's the city allows you to pay to have an inspector come in, and it's not, they don't charge the violations to, if they find anything, to the owner, the current owner. So my agent said, we're coming in and we're bringing in a city inspector. And the owner said, no, you're not. We're not letting you in this building again. So it was within our inspection period. So being from River West, we went in with the city inspector. We didn't tell him we were trespassing, but I really wanted to buy the building. And I have 2 pages of, you know, violations that they were given to me. And basically the owner is, well, if they find any violations, we'll have to claim that. If you pull out of this deal, then we'll have to tell the next buyer that there are all these violations, so you can't go in there. And I'm like, well, okay, thanks.
Let me stop you for a quick second, Rosemary. Your people are living in this building at this time, correct?
Yes.
There are tenants in there that are not aware.
There are current tenants. Yes.
And you told me that the inspector said something. Tell me what he said, something very shocking to you about the condition of the electrical system in there. Did he not?
Well, he said he'd never seen anything so bad. And he was shocked at what he saw. There's so many things wrong down in the basement. It's sort of terrifying to think of. I'm having them all fixed. Very large bill.
Yeah, well, and tell us, I mean, that's one of the arguments, you know, from landlord associations is that, like, it would be unrealistic to ask people to bring their properties up to code. Give us a ballpark on what you might
say. I don't think it's unrealistic. I think it's about $22,000. That's for openers. I still have plumbing to do, too. But to upgrade the system so that we live in a modern world here, we have a million things in our kitchen that we plug in. And when you plug those things in, it's going to overload the wires. So we're upgrading everything in the basement, you know.
Mitch, I saw you shaking your head a little bit. Is this something you hear from clients regularly? I mean, you're hearing people, tenants that live in these conditions. What do you see?
Yeah. I was reacting to the comment that, you know, it's unrealistic and expensive to bring buildings up to code, rental housing up to code. It's the same refrain that actually, you know, we've heard historically when things like seatbelts were proposed, airbags were proposed, anti-lock brakes were proposed, that it would destroy the automotive industry and no one would ever be able to afford a car again. And clearly that has happened, and that's why we all walk and bike everywhere. it's just not the case, right? These things are necessary safety precautions. They're a change, they're hard to make changes, they're expensive, but they save lives, and that's what matters.
Mitch is the director of the UW Economic Justice Institute, Rosemary Oliveira is a Milwaukee landlord, and Justin Padway is a lawyer representing the family of Clarence Morrell, who was killed in an electrical fire. They all participated in the latest Listen MKE, moderated by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Raquel Rutledge. The event took place on Facebook Live on Tuesday, and you can find the full conversation at WUWM.com. Last month, Lake Effect's Mallory Chang spoke with 2 investigative reporters who worked on the report about electrical fires, and you can also find that conversation at WUWM.com. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about a series of events coming up at the UW-Milwaukee Manfred Olson Planetarium based around Latin American culture. But first, we'll learn about ransomware attacks, how they can happen, and how you can protect yourself. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, It's an effort by the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency to make people think about the ways they can personally protect themselves from bad actors and phishing attempts. As more of us have moved into working online, opportunities for these attacks have only increased. Recently, ransomware attacks have threatened both our personal security and the security of our infrastructure. But there are ways we can protect ourselves and the businesses we depend on. Lake Effect's Joy Powers digs into this issue with the CEO of Syslogic, Tina Chang, Bryce Williams, Syslogic's cybersecurity practice lead, and Walt Schilling, a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MSOE.
What is the landscape of ransomware attacks like right now? Because it seems like they've been increasing over the last couple of years.
Well, they're definitely increasing, I think, in volume and severity. They're getting more visibility in media and press just because of the targets that are being attacked, and as well as the impact it has just on, you know, general consumers, general people. They hear about things like the Colonial Pipeline attack. They hear about things like JBS meat processing. And whereas it may not have impacted them as much in years past, I think now it's just becoming more visible in terms of targets. And there's certainly more of them. I think, and also the dollar amounts associated with those attacks is only going up. The demands have increased as the organizations behind them recognize that this is a good way for them to make money.
It's pretty profound when we think that just a couple of decades ago, many people didn't have email. And many organizations and companies really started to adopt email over the last couple of decades, where now, as we looked at the pandemic and everybody went home to work remote, everybody's working electronically. And so we're just opening up the doors and becoming a bit more ripe for things like ransomware, which easily finds its way into the network through email and or through particular user behavior that may not be as disciplined as we would like. So we've just got a bigger open door with a bigger market right now.
Well, that gets to this question of really what is a ransomware attack? Because it seems like it can come in a variety of forms. It's not just one kind of thing.
With ransomware, typically what we're seeing is an adversary that is trying to lock or prevent you from accessing some sort of resource that you need, be that data that you may need to complete your job, be it files, be it work items that you're working on. And essentially what will happen is the adversary will end up with that file being encrypted to where you no longer have access to it. How they attack you, again, can come in via email, via clicking on a web link, via many, many different ways. The key thing is that once ransomware attack has occurred, the adversary has control of your files and you don't have access to them at that point in time.
So let's play out a possible scenario there. You know, I'm on my email. I get perhaps a message from someone who seems like I might know them, but maybe I don't. I press on a link. Is that how they're kind of getting into my computer? Is it something like they call me, they ask for, you know, information that then gets them a password? Are these different ways that they can kind of get that information, get into the system?
Yes, all of those are possibilities. There's often more sophisticated ways to, they may convince you to install something that you think is doing something else for you, providing them remote access or who knows. There's a lot of not just the email itself, but there may be social engineering involved where they're tricking you into thinking there's someone working on your behalf from a utility provider or a computer support person. And then if it's inside of an organization, I think the possibilities only increase because there's more people involved. There's more ways in which they can enter the network, et cetera.
So you mentioned the files become encrypted or inaccessible, perhaps. As somebody who does not work in this kind of industry, when I hear encrypted, I get the contours of the meaning of that, but I don't exactly know what that means. But I do know that it means these files are no longer accessible by me. What is the impact of that?
I guess if you wanted to translate it into something that's maybe a little different environment, let's say we were talking about access to your house. You have your key to your house and you can get into your house. Encryption would be the equivalent of someone coming in and changing the locks so that you no longer could get into your house and that the external person would be the only one that could actually access into your house. Ransomware then essentially is, the idea is that you would then potentially pay a ransom to get the locks of your house changed back to the original key.
So what does that ransom look like? What does this encounter, I guess, look like?
Joy, I think that could take all shapes and forms these days. Now, obviously, if you're a cyber criminal, you're probably going to go after the biggest pocketbook you can find. So large amounts of ability to pay large sums is frequently subject to greater attack. However, cyber criminals are also going to places where there's really sensitive data. So think private healthcare data, financial data, et cetera. And they may not use that data tomorrow, but they may hold on to it, or they may find the highest bidder for it, or they may actually go and grab encrypted data today and hope that in 10 years, there's going to be ways to de-encrypt that information so they can make use of it later. So I think we're seeing all forms of hacking and all forms of ransomware happening wherever somebody can proliferate their position.
One of the big questions I think anyone has with this is who is at risk? But it sounds like from what you're saying, really kind of everyone's at risk, anyone who uses a computer at least.
Right. And I think more so these days, people recognize that someone else getting hit by ransomware can impact them, like the Colonial Pipeline, even if it may have not have impacted anyone directly. The idea of it happening definitely caused a lot of concern. People scrambling to get fuel when the fuel was fine in their area. That's the concern. I think that, you know, these supply chain organizations, those that play a critical role in that, not only does that impact everyone, but there's an urgency associated with getting that resolved. And that's what the attackers like to take advantage of. Something where you have to move quickly. So it's more likely that you're going to pay that ransom versus stick it out and try and solve the problem.
So how do we protect ourselves? Not just as individuals who have, you know, our own computers, our own emails, and our own systems that we want to protect, but also as people who work at businesses that have information that these kinds of hackers may want.
I just spent a couple of days out in DC meeting with one of our agencies, CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And they said the number one thing that we can do as individuals to protect ourselves is to turn on MFA or multi-factor authentication. And essentially what that is, it's a double checker to your password login. So picture yourself logging in via password or maybe your fingerprint via your mobile phone. And oftentimes you'll receive a secondary email or a text message with a code. A code that was generated just for you that then you have to enter to ensure that you are the person that is trying to log in. And they said that if each person turned on MFA, they could prevent about 90% of attacks that may be coming your way. So MFA would definitely be my top pick, turning on multi-factor authentication.
What are some other ways that we can protect ourselves from these attacks? I know one of the ways in which people sometimes access this information that we don't always think about is through phone calls.
Yes, I think that if you just have a healthy concern where you want to validate someone who's calling you, just to ensure that they are who they say they are, that's a very good practice to take. Whether that's calling back their organization via their published phone number, just so that you can, you know, reach that same individual. That's a fairly quick and easy way of validating that person actually works for the organization that they say they do. In much the same way, if someone comes to your door, you'd want to check their ID or their company badge to make sure that they're, you know, who they say they are. That's a good practice. It's very easy these days for someone to masquerade as working for a specific company when they're not really doing so. So that's another good recommendation.
I would love to see consumers think about cybersecurity every day, because this is becoming a more and more real threat inside of our homes. If we think about how many electronic devices we have in our homes these days, everything from the Alexa to the smart TV or the smart refrigerator, we're connecting all these devices together within our home networks. And there aren't great mandates of what those products need to look like as far as the cybersecurity that they're mandated to have. And we don't, as users, always pay good attention to all the settings that we need to configure in each of those devices. And what happens if you put more and more devices on your network? Well, you're opening up theoretically more and more doors to a cyber criminal. It's like keeping your front door and multiple windows open. I just don't think as the average everyday individual, we think about life that way. I would love for us to just independently get more aware of how we're using electronic devices and the impact it may have.
All right. Well, Tina, Bryce, Walter, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Joy.
Tina Chang is the CEO of Syslogic, Bryce Williams is Syslogic's cybersecurity practice lead, and Walt Schilling is a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MSOE. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about cybersecurity and the impact of ransomware. UWM is hosting a month-long series celebrating Latin American cultures and their connections to the night sky.
And have that connection of you have that cultural affinity, that sense of nationality that goes beyond other restrictions and political issues. And it's that feeling of even if I were born in the moon, I would still be Boricua.
We'll tell you more about Culturas Celestiales next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The stars hold deep cultural connections around the globe. All month long, the UW-Milwaukee Manfred Olson Planetarium is hosting Culturas Celestiales, a series of events celebrating Latin American culture's connections to the night sky. Nancy Bird Soto is a professor of Spanish at UWM. She'll be hosting an event about Puerto Rico later this month. Ahead of that, she spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for joining me here on Lake Effect. Could you tell me about the program and what are the events about?
Yes, so this program comes from an invitation that I received in late spring, early summer, from Dr. Jean Creighton, who is the director of the UWM Planetarium. And she wanted me to talk about if I could do a presentation about, you know, South American cultures in relation to the cosmos for Latinx Heritage Month this year in 2021. And then I thought, well, that's pretty broad. So I said, well, you know, I could probably talk more about Puerto Rico, you know, from a cultural perspective. And then I suggested other people on campus, like Professor David Pacifico, who's going to be doing the presentation about Peru. So instead of being this one, just one presentation, one show, we ended up having four. So now we're going to have Chile and Brazil and Peru, and then I'll do the last one in late October about Puerto Rico. We had also a long conversation over the summer about what to call this, because you're talking about, you know, many countries and many cultural aspects that could become, I mean, this could become like a year-long seminar, right? Like a huge, you know, class with different guests. So we came up with terms that would be easily recognizable for English speakers, you know, like culturas, right, cultures. And then so in Spanish, celestiales, which is, you know, celestial. And then since we also have Brazil, then culturas celestiais, which is the same thing. And then visually, these are cognates. So we wanted something that would convey the Spanish, the Portuguese, and something that you don't need to know Spanish and Portuguese to actually relate and connect. And I hope everybody can attend and join all four sessions.
That's so fun. Jean Creighton is a reoccurring guest on Lake Effect. What can people anticipate to learn about?
This is actually a virtual program, right? So it's going to be slightly different if we were actually on site at the planetarium. For those, you actually have the second part where you actually look at the night sky within, you know, the planetarium, you know, the physical place. So this is more about a presentation that connects more with the culture and how, you know, like different constellations or even, you know, the planning of cities like Latin America and the Caribbean, you have you know, the Calle Sol, so the Street of the Sun, or Calle Luna for the moon, and how there is that presence of the cosmos even in, you know, in city planning, in cultural events. I mean, it's not like a hyper scientific presentation, right? That sometimes we could expect at a more traditional planetarium show, but it's also about highlighting cultures of different places within the context of Latinx Heritage Month. And also knowing that because we ended up having the four different presentations, it actually goes a little bit beyond Latinx Heritage Month and through the month of October.
And Nancy, what can people expect to hear from your presentation about Puerto Rico? Can you give us a snippet of what you'll be talking about?
Yes. So in the cities, like I mentioned, the Calle Sol, Calle Luna, and from that also talk about the connection between Puerto Rico culturally, also to topics related to astronomy. Like, yes, about a year ago, or almost a year ago, the Arecibo Observatory, the radio telescope, actually collapsed, which was, you know, that was news that were pretty harsh to hear and actually to watch images. But also, I mean, on the other hand, recently in the last few weeks, there was a group of students, of astronomy students in Puerto Rico. So this new generation that actually had this new satellite that went up through SpaceX. So there's, it's going to be the first Puerto Rican satellite. So not just talking about, you know, the collapse of the Arecibo Observatory, but also adding bits of information that actually include things that are happening with new generations. So there's still that motivation to connect to astronomy and to the skies. As a literature professor, I'm going to be including towards the end of the presentation some quotes, some snippets from poems in which you see like that connection between the cosmos and part of, you know, the like the Taino heritage, the African heritage in the culture, right, to bring all those influences. And also include a snippet from a poem that became a song that is Boricua en la Luna, and talk about that cultural affinity to Puerto Rico, that it doesn't matter where you're born, and have that connection of, you have that cultural affinity, that sense of nationality that goes beyond other restrictions and political issues. And it's that feeling of, even if I were born in the moon, I would still be Boricua. And Boricua is that word that describes Puerto Ricans both from the island and from the diaspora in a way that, you know, the term itself actually goes back to the Taino, the indigenous name for the island, for Boriquen. So it's kind of like really getting into those roots of, you know, it goes beyond politics and classifications of, oh, you were born here or there. Again, from the streets to the music, to the cultural affinities, to adding some of the literary quotes and excerpts, and also bringing it to those great news of those students who are actually working on satellites.
Nancy, at the UWM Planetarium, where is your favorite place to go? And where is a place that you recommend that people look under or look at during their time in there?
It's such a cozy and welcoming environment. I think there is no bad seat in that planetarium, but if you get there early so that you can find a seat in the back row, I think that gives you the best perspective. But then again, there's no bad seat there. And actually, I've been going to that planetarium since I started at UWM, so I've had a very long connection with it. It's one of those places that it's amazing, and for some people, it's like a hidden gem. I would recommend that people always check the calendar and, you know, try an in-person event whenever it feels safe for people. Also, you know, when you also have virtual events, it makes it also more accessible. You can be pretty much anywhere. Also, I think adding, you know, thinking of Latinx Heritage Month, I would encourage people also to think of that term and how we have gotten there, and how maybe in 5 years it might be, you know, a different term to use. But it's also about being inclusive, right? With you know, Latinx, some people are using Latina with an E at the end. So, I mean, it's not about perfect terms, but also trying to be more inclusive with so many identities that form, you know, the Latin American, Caribbean, U.S. Latinx world. And, you know, it's like a cosmos of communities, pretty much.
Nancy Bird Soto is a professor of Spanish at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. The first event will be held tomorrow at the UWM Planetarium, and you can find more information about it at wuwm.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Like Effect each week with help from Chase Browning and Kelby Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from education reporter Emily Files and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trevor Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation about how a group of fourth graders helped to get Indigenous Peoples Day recognized statewide. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, just look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.